Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We also link to our guests, so we encourage you to check out our guests, their websites, and the information that they have to offer, because that's what it's there for. You'll not find much information other than the name and the link on my website, because I don't like to reinvent the wheel. The wheel's been invented at the website of our guests. So go there and get all that good information and learn what you can and use what you want and have a more fulfilling life. Be more involved in your process. We're going to talk today with Adele Ryan McDowell. She is Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell, PhD. She has a book out called Making Peace with Suicide, A Handbook of Hope, Understanding, and Comfort. Why are we talking about this? Because this is, believe it or not, one of the forms of transition, if you will, self-induced, more so than if you just wait for the natural progression of just living life. Some would even say that some of our lifestyles are a slower version of suicide, depending upon what we're doing to ourselves and our bodies, and we may touch a little bit upon that. But first of all, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us via Skype. Adele, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Richard. I'm excited to be here.
This, obviously, there's a lot of gloom over the subject when people talk about suicide. I remember years ago, I interviewed some folks back in Phoenix who were part of an organization called Suiciders Anonymous. And it was just like all of the other 12-step programs. You had a sponsor, you had 12 steps, and you had to surrender to a higher power and so on and so forth. And the biggest difference between those and AA or whatever other 12-step programs there are is that if you fell off the wagon, you were gone.
That's right.
It was over for you from that standpoint. As far as we know, I mean, that's the other aspect of this, is that we don't know what's on the other side. We don't know what to expect. We hope, we pray, we believe, we theorize, and so on and so forth. But nobody knows. Nobody knows for certain. And for some, that is plenty of a deterrent for leaving this world prematurely because they don't know, and there's a lot of fear in that regard. But then there's more fear being here. And I'm going to share with you, Adele, a case in point.
Okay.
True story, not mine, although I'm related to the story. I know of someone who basically... And I found out about this some years ago. Lost her mother. Actually, lost her father. He had an aneurysm.
Mm-hmm.
And just, he went. And, of course, they knew this aneurysm was there for decades. But, of course, there was nothing. It was a brain aneurysm. There was nothing they could do.
Okay.
Mother passed away 4 months later. Mm-hmm. And it was actually classified as dying of a broken heart.
Right.
Then the best friend died on the operating table.
Wow.
This person didn't want to be here. Didn't want to be here before those passings. Even more so, was mad at them for leaving because she couldn't go.
Right.
I even found out that she even attempted to leave while I was on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't find this out until a couple of years after the fact, which was rather shocking to me, thinking that, oh my God, I could have come home from that trip. And so there are a couple of sides, well, many sides to this, but two in particular, the person who is not wanting to be here. And let's talk a little bit about that. I'm curious as to your interest in this subject. Why does this intrigue you to the extent that you've written Making Peace with Suicide?
Okay, I have so many things to say. Let me tell you how I came to the book, but I also want to look at this from a lot of perspectives. I came to the book because a colleague of mine in California that I knew from a shamanism and healing conference died by suicide. I got a phone call from some mutual friends, and I mean, this is a person I saw when I went to the conference every year, every other year. I said, oh my gosh, I just sent her an email for her 65th birthday. I knew, la la la, we'd have a little email exchange. And they were all hemming and hawing, and they said, well, maybe suicide. And at that moment, I'll call her Susan. Susan came into my inner screen and waved at me and told me, yes, it was a suicide and that she was fine. I'm doing dishes at the kitchen sink a few weeks later, and that little voice within, right, the gods whisper to me and say, Adele, you need to write a book on suicide. I'm like, what? But I have learned to listen over the years. The older you get, you do gain a little wisdom, and one of those pieces of wisdom is that I do listen now, and for the most part. So I started writing the book and interviewing people, and I'll tell you, in the beginning, Richard, it was tough going. I felt like I was crawling over barbed wire and broken glass, and I also was having a lot of the people who had died by suicide around me, right? I would see faces on the tiles in the shower. I would see groupings in a frame on the carpeting. I would look out the window and in the leaves of the trees. And in the last few weeks, I've had a few more folks come around my bed. So everything that I had done in my life, suicide, the first suicide hotline in the country for paraprofessionals, meaning volunteers, I did when I was in college in the early 70s. I had a mother who was suicidal. I worked domestic violence and sexual assault, rape crisis hotlines. Was in a drug clinic working with people there. So I had a lot of exposure and a lot of people. I even have on my phone currently a picture that one of my clients sent me from a bridge in New York City where he was considering taking his life. Happily, he did not, but he got that close and to that place. Now, why do people choose suicide, right? There are a lot of reasons. On the 3D level, if you will, look at, you know, there was a talk on PBS about, you know, there have been a lot of suicides because of economics in Greece, but they're anticipating more. I believe Greece and Ireland and Italy have started hotlines, and they never had them before, right? You look at the farmers in India. You've got family history, right? If there's been suicide or mental illness or violence or whatever in your family, you've got physical issues. We could use Robin Williams as an example because he had what was called Lewy body dementia, that some kind of indication of a kind of dementia that is paired with Parkinson's. And you see it with, traumatic brain injury moves into something called CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And we've seen that with a lot of our vets. And of course, there's always psychological pain, which we would understand. Social issues, I mean, cyberbullying is an enormous, we lose so many people, young people, and trauma of every shape and form, right? I've never worked with a childhood sexual abuse survivor who hasn't been suicidal. And a lot of PTSD. And then if you walk with me across the bridge and looking at it from a soul perspective, I also believe that we have an energy of suicide on the planet now. And some of that is the robotic, soulless lives we're living, and you refer to that in your opening. And I also believe that there are advanced souls who, and I'll even put Robin Williams in this category because I believe this, who raise their soul hands and say, it's time for me to go. And we'll go back to my friend Susan in the course of writing the book. And this was through someone else who gave me this information, not knowing anything. Susan, very, very busy on the other side, and said, I didn't have the energy of cancer. I didn't want to chance a car accident and hurt somebody else. And so she had been hospitalized for depression, and after she got out of the hospital, she had taken her life. And she says, I'm busier than ever and doing work on the other side. Now, I know for many people this might be really radical, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, what I find interesting, and I was trying to find it here real quickly. I haven't yet, so I'm not even going to bother trying. I think I have the title of the film Robin starred in. I think it was something along the lines of Somewhere in Time, or What Time Will Bring, or something of this nature.
I didn't see it, but I've heard about it. Wasn't it Somewhere in the Dream, so? Was it
something like, yes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
His wife, in the film, his wife committed suicide.
Correct.
And he wanted to bring her back.
Right.
Which was an interesting premise in and of itself.
Right.
I don't remember the conclusion. I don't know if he stayed or if he was able to bring her back or if he left her and made peace and all of this. But it was just an extraordinary journey. And I find it interesting with people like him in particular. And I'll even look at people along the lines of like a Steve Martin, too. I remember tapping into their careers at a young age myself, laughing along with their humor and so forth, and then watching as they grew. And if they got into television or movies, you began to see a dark side, a real melancholy type of expression in their demeanor. Now, not so much Steve, but especially Robin, with a lot of the darker types of films. They weren't horror films, but I mean, I certainly wouldn't put, was it The Fisher King?
Yeah, The Fisher King, where he was the homeless man. He was excellent.
Yeah, that wasn't a comedy, not from my perspective. There were some funny moments, but it wasn't a comedy, per se. It had some very serious moments in it. But I find that interesting that when you have people like that, and you start to observe those kinds of transitions, if you will, to me that seemed like a real red flag. And I wasn't his therapist. I wasn't following him that closely, but I thought, this is very strange. Why is this guy, who is Mr. Funny Man all the time, you know?
Oh, I would so disagree with you.
Okay.
Oh, this is going to be fun. I would so disagree with you, Richard, because I think, number one, we human beings are multidimensional beings. Number two, we cannot be happy, chirpy all the time. There's another side of us. Carl Jung, the great Swiss psychiatrist, would say, imagine, in my day, it was a teeter-totter or a seesaw, right? Mm-hmm. And if you only show one side of you is up, the happy side, when that other side comes up, you know, you need to integrate all parts of yourselves. We all have days that we feel bad or blue. Mm-hmm. We might have years where we've been in a tremendous funk. I would contend that the majority of the world has held, even in the most abstract form for a couple of seconds, the thought of suicide in their hand. Not that they were going to do something, but oh my God, if the pod people came and took me away today, I'd be okay. I'm tired. I'm done. I'm exhausted. Not saying they're doing it, but part of the human experience. We go through all of these emotions. I think Robin was showing the depth and the fullness of his personality. Mm-hmm. I also think he had a great love and affinity for the vets, make a good Good Morning Vietnam, and mm-hmm. the homeless, that, and showing those dimensions. And he took us out to the edge and showed us, as I think he has done with suicide, the things we don't want to look at.
You know, it's interesting. I've been rewatching some of the old television series that I grew up with, like Cheers and Wings and Frasier, and I'm watching the entire series of MASH. And I just watched an episode where they brought in this doctor to fill in because the mumps had hit the MASH. And this guy apparently was talking about the experiences that he had in a place called Busan. Just horrific, he's talking about. And he's there in surgery over and over and over again, eventually winds up sitting on the floor inside the colonel's tent. He's frustrated because he can't get the blood off his hands, which I thought was strange because normally you're wearing gloves while you're doing surgery, but be that as it may. And he basically snapped. Well, the poignant part of it was when the two surgeons, Hawkeye and BJ, walked out of the tent, and BJ says, well, man, he's just as strong as the rest of us. To which Hawkeye says, yeah, that's what scares me. Is that we...
That's brilliant.
We
that's brilliant.
All have that potential, the potential tipping point.
Yes. And it comes... It's usually, I don't think there's just one reason someone takes their life. I think that there are a confluence of reasons and stressors. And I'm talking about on the straight 3D level, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are a bunch of things that happen. And, you know, I don't know if you saw the movie American Sniper, right?
I did, actually. And anyway, go ahead.
I thought Bradley Cooper was brilliant. And there's a scene, you know, we're getting close to the end, and he has come home from his last tour of duty. And instead of going straight home to his wife, he calls her from a bar. And he says something like, I'm here, I'm home. And she's like, well, what are you doing there? Why aren't you here? And he said, I needed a minute, right? I needed a minute. Mm. And when he found out he could be of service, right, that changed his life around.
Yeah.
But the, which is actually, I want to add this, I've talked to so many people around the world who have lost a loved one to suicide and or who have been suicidal themselves. And in families where there have been multiple suicides, it's like a cloud hanging over their head or a neurobiology or something, right? Mm-hmm. And, oh my gosh, this is old age. The thought I had just went out of my mind. It was a really good one. It'll come back in a minute.
Sure. Well, to me, it's... you're talking about being of service, and it's like I guess I can speak this because I was in the relationship. My ex-wife was diagnosed by a doctor through the process of divorce as being having chronic fatigue and depression.
Right.
Which at the time I thought, well, that's a nice diagnosis to have if you're trying to nail me and, you know, hurt me and so forth. But that was also one of the reasons that she was the way that she was that turned the relationship. And she also was self-abusing. She would hurt herself. Okay. And I didn't know about it until about 3 or 4 years before we divorced, that she'd been doing it for 4 or 5 or more years, even during our marriage, and would say, oh, I just ran into the coffee table. I tripped over the dog. She had a guide dog. Or all of these other things, not knowing that she felt this way. And so, again, yeah, kind of going back to those signs that I talked about with the comedians, sometimes we don't even see them. We're not even aware that they're there because... I don't know. Is it because we just haven't been educated? And why would we need to be educated? Because it's not something we think about.
Well, let's bring that down a little bit. I think all human beings have moments, and sometimes there's a cluster, and it can end in a place where I had a woman send me a text one night that I worked with, and she was going through a really rough time with her teenage sons, and... her partner and his relationship with her teenage sons, and she put herself in the bathroom and cut herself. Never done it before. And, you know, we had a long conversation about it, but for her, it was a way of dealing, not a good way, let me be really clear, not a good way, but a way of her dealing with her emotions, and because she didn't know how else to handle them at the moment. Mm. I think, you know, I have a chapter in the book called, you know, Is Addiction a Slow Form of Suicide? And with advanced intractable addiction, the answer is yes.
And I even mentioned that at the front end of the program.
Yes.
With people who have, and a lot of people wouldn't consider these addictions per se, but depending upon the volume of alcohol you're drinking, if you smoke... If you work in a particular industry that you know is hazardous to your health, you know, live in a place that you know is hazardous to your health, or even live in a relationship that is hazardous, that you know is hazardous to your health, those would qualify, wouldn't they?
Well, okay.
To some degree.
All right, but there are places where you don't have control.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
And let's have a little compassion. We all make the choices we make with the knowledge or consciousness we have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, I used to be a 3-pack-a-day smoker. I'm not anymore. Did I know it was unhealthy at the time? Hell yeah. Ooh, yes, I did. But I...
it's okay.
But I, you know, I got to the point where I knew I had to stop, mm-hmm. right? And so it's like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And it's been decades, and I'm very happy about that. But we all, everything, you know, if we look at ourselves on that, we raised our hands, our soul hands, and said, yes, please, I'm willing to come into this lifetime to have these experiences. And from my perception, and I'm taking a walk on the wild side here with you, Richard, that we humans are here. We have feelings, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has been said other places are different. They do not have the feeling components that we have. We humans are the great experiment and how we deal with our feelings. And I think our relationships with people, with jobs, with substances, and those become our great teachers and how we become aware of ourselves. You know, we all muck up. We're mm-hmm. we're humans. We make mistakes, but that makes us perfectly human. But we learn and we grow and we develop. And so I'm not going to wag my finger at anybody because I'm just like everybody else. But I think that, for example, Robin Williams' suicide has created more conversation around the topic. Plus, the statistics are startling. In the U.S., there is a suicide approximately every 13 minutes. The World Health Organization will tell us that around the globe, on average, there is a suicide every 40 seconds. That's a whole lot of pain. A whole lot of pain.
Mm. And, of course, not wanting to be judgmental, just taking a look at the various categories, if you will. And that was one of the things that I wanted to dive into. If you have information on this, I mean, you've touched upon the U.S. statistics and obviously the global statistics. But I'm wondering if we were to go country by country, does it really matter in terms of the suicide rates? If let's say... I'm just going to throw this out. Let's just say Iceland has the lowest suicide rate on the planet. Does okay. that mean it's the best place to live? And well, and by converse, the United States has, let's just say, I don't know, has the worst, the highest suicide rate. It's the worst place to live. If you want to live.
And see, I would think so. I think suicide becomes a social issue, right? It is how we care for those that need a helping hand. What kind of support systems? Like there, on Facebook, there's been a lot of things recently showing, I believe it's prisons in Norway, and their model is very different than U.S. prisons, and their recidivism rate is exceedingly low, and it's more of a, it's not a punitive kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are different views on how you do this, but in the U.S. there's, I don't know the exact percentage, but there is a high rate of suicide in prison, which I would think prison would be a horrifying place. If I was ever in a prison, you would find me in the corner rocking back and forth. It would upset me so much. So to your point, It's how we live our lives, the quality of our lives, the quality of our relationships. You know, time is a resource, how we use time. The farmers in India who, I'm going to take a loan against my future crops so I can send my kids to the city for education.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crops, because of a drought or GMO seeds or whatever the combination of things that might be happening there, then the New York Times did a whole big article on how the people who, the moneylenders, were just harping and harassing the families. And they interviewed a woman who lost her husband to suicide for that reason. And she said, I didn't understand until they came and harassed me. And all I wanted to do was die. But the children were here and I couldn't do it. How we treat one another is often unconscionable.
And I've had a real hard time understanding that kind of an attitude towards others that really is anything but productive.
Right.
It's like, wait a minute. How is it, and I'll just use this as an example, how is it helping both you, Mr. Corporation, and a little customer over here who has overdrawn their bank account? How is it helping them and you if you start charging them a fee every day that they're overdrawn and a late fee for this and on and on? How is that helping the situation? You know, I understand you're a business. I understand you're in business to make money. But if you destroy this individual, is it the attitude that there are 7 billion people on a planet? Losing one is not a big deal to us. We'll get another one. I have to wonder if maybe that's the attitude that it doesn't matter whether we harass them or not. There's 6,995,000,000, whatever, more people on the planet that we can draw into this.
And you look at toxicities.
Yeah.
Whether your company is dumping toxic stuff in the river and all the kids are getting leukemia in the neighborhood, or you look at people using an anti-pest thing that is not allowed in certain countries around the world because of its toxic. I like you, Richard, everybody's entitled to make a right livelihood.
Sure.
I don't begrudge anybody that. But I, at the cost of other people, that's the heartbreaking thing.
Yeah.
And of course, I believe, you know, just add, you know, I believe that we all do have the power. You know, if we can be the best we can be and act with compassion, it doesn't mean we're perfect, but it does mean that, you know, we try to consider other people. We can't do everything, but in our small world, whatever we can do, I think those bits of light add up.
And it's really interesting. In my experiences early on in my broadcast career, people would come to me at the radio station, and they would want me to do these little projects for them.
Uh-huh.
And I would say, well, okay, sure, let's talk about, you know, what it's going to cost. And when I first started doing this, that I wanted to charge sort of the going rate. Well, these were small individual people who didn't have a lot of money. And I basically decided I'd rather do the work for the small amount than not do the work at all for nothing.
You're a good man.
And, well, I tried, and yet I was criticized by people for doing that, because you're underselling yourself. You know, you're cutting yourself short and so on and so forth. You deserve more. So, well, of course I deserve more, but these people also deserve to get their message out, which I thought was very important. And honestly, it didn't matter what their message was, you know, obviously up to a point. I was working for a Christian radio station. There were lots of different perspectives. And I thought, look, your message is important. It's important enough to me that I want to make sure that you are heard. It's clean. It's clear. It's understandable. It's audible and so forth. And I want the listener to make up their own mind about what you have to offer. Okay? That's not for me to say whether or not it's important or not. For me to say, I want to make sure that others can make their own minds up. And that's what we do here on this program. I may agree or disagree with you or any of my other guests. The point is, we want to get the information out there. We want to help people. We want to guide people to thrive more in this lifetime before we move on to the next. And before we move on to our next question, we're going to take a short break here. We're talking with Adele Ryan McDowell, PhD, and she is the author of Making Peace with Suicide. She has a website. Yes, she does. She actually has a couple of them. I found one of them rather interesting in name. It was AdeleandThePenguin.com. She also has Adele Ryan McDowell. .com. That's the website. You can also Google Making Peace with Suicide. I you know, that's how I found her the first time. In any event, we encourage you to check her out, and we also encourage you to stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We'll be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for staying with us as we talk with Adele Ryan McDowell, a PhD. She's written the book entitled Making Peace with Suicide. She has a website called AdeleRyanMcDowell.com, as well as Adele and the Penguin. That's an interesting title, to say the very least, AdeleAndThePenguin.com. We'll talk a little bit about that. But you also have another book called Balancing Act, which sort of, I think that it sort of dovetails into what we're talking about here in terms of trying to have, in some way, shape, or form in this life, a balanced life. And sometimes it's really hard. I moved from Phoenix to Santa Barbara.
Right.
Specifically, not exclusively.
Yes.
To be able to get to the beach and to the water and to relax and to sort of become the surf and to be the sand and the breeze and just, you know, immerse myself in that whole thing. And in the 9 years that I have been here, I've probably spent, I don't know, a grand total of 2 weeks, if I was to put all that time together. And I sit here going, and I'm 20 minutes walking from the beach. I'm 20 days walking to the beach from Phoenix. So it's so much nicer here. But the whole aspect of trying to have a balanced life seems next to impossible. I know it's not impossible, but it's next to impossible in terms of not getting caught up in a lot of, granted, we must embrace the totality of who we are. So what you talked about in the first segment, both our light and dark side, that's what makes us who we are. Mm-hmm. But not getting stuck or lost there to the point where and by the way, I'm curious, who is the title directed at? Who is making peace with suicide?
Good question.
That's a great question. And there are multiple answers. It's entitled for people who have lost a loved one to suicide. The book is for people who themselves are suicidal or have been suicidal, as well as those who work with or counsel the suicidal or the suicidally bereaved.
Are you familiar with groups like Suiciders Anonymous?
No, I'd never heard of it until you mentioned it.
Yeah. I have to say that every time that I associated with members of the group, I never attended any of their meetings, and probably wouldn't have been appropriate to do so anyway, because I wasn't in that place. But I always felt, as much as I enjoyed being around them to a point, I always felt there was that sort, because you mentioned this, that sort of dark cloud, that there was that aura about them.
I have to tell you, when you mentioned it, I thought, wow, people are suicidal for a lot of reasons, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Certainly there can be depression. It's considered the number one reason, but depression is a clinical term. And, you know, in the world, you could have a lot of events that make you depressed, or there can be unresolved grief, or there can be something that requires, treatment. You know, when you can't get out of bed, that requires certainly more serious treatment and medication and different kinds of skills so you get back on your feet. But also, when people are drinking or using, they can be very depressed. There was some study years ago that said, and I laugh because a lot of psychology studies to me are a flare for the obvious. We kind of already know the answer, but I guess we need to do the studies. Anyway, 90% of, I think they did the study with men, not women, alcoholic men were depressed. Well, that really isn't too surprising, is it? Because you would use the alcohol or the drugs or whatever it was to not deal with your feelings, right? Because you were in a place where it was too uncomfortable to deal with them. So a Suiciders Anonymous group,
wow, that I have to wrap my head around it, because there would be so many different people who could walk through that door, and I would think that their needs would be so varied. But of course, the overarching need is, how do we support each other to stay alive? But I'd never heard of the group.
Yeah. Well, I think that what you have to offer through this work, I think, is extremely valuable. It's extremely important as well. Again, the title is Making Peace with Suicide. It's a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. Again, the author is Adele Ryan McDowell. And one of the things that I happened to come across in your book, and I thought it was really very interesting, and you have these eight takeaways, or Adele's takeaways. But I liked the last one most assuredly. Trust your good instincts and intuition. Now, you made reference to the fact that you sometimes, as you've gotten older, you followed it more and more. Years ago, I used to attend these personal growth and development programs. And in one of them, they had us write down on a large piece of construction paper sort of this promise, if you will, or statement or what have you. And I basically put down that I would listen to, and then in very large letters, and follow the promptings, the promptings of what I like to call my friend.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I can't say that I have done that 100% any more than you can, but I often say on this program that if you're not going to follow, then stop listening. What's the point? I mean, I say that facetiously. I say it facetiously. But I mean, come on. Seriously. Because it's there to guide you. It may challenge you. It will never put you in harm's way. But it's there to guide you along your life's path, to help you through. But then when I was talking with somebody else, they said, yeah, but there are those out there who hear other voices. And how can you be sure the voice that they're listening to is the true voice, if you will, of wisdom and guidance and love and blah, 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 blah.
Right. And I have worked with a lot of people who are intuitive, but who have also heard voices. And when the voices, for example, I had a gentleman call me, he found my phone number in the phone book, and he called me one night. It was a Friday night, and I work with him, and he said, hey, Adele, I want to chop off my penis with a knife. I said, you know, that's not really a good idea, and how about we get you into the hospital? He goes, I don't want to go. Now, I'm truncating this conversation, but I said, I know you don't want to go, but I want you to be safe, and I want you to be alive, because he had voices in his head who were telling him to do that. Obviously, I have another gentleman I work with, and he goes, my intuition, but his intuition is always telling him his worst fears. I said, no, that's not your intuition. That's the kid part of you who's still so scared. It's not your intuition. As you said, you know, the intuition, it's loving, it's benign, it's not, you feel it, and there's a visceral response. I have been, you know, my family laughs. They're like, oh, you know, now you're doing this, or you're going to do that, or, you know, what direction? And okay, my voice, you know, when I'm doing the dishes over the kitchen sink. And then when I start doing the book, I realize how so many threads in my life led me to this place. And it's not just suicide, but it's also taking that leap to the other side. You know, is death the final frontier? Needless to say, I don't believe that. I think it's something like, it's a wonderful life. We don't necessarily have Clarence the angel saying this is what your life would look like if you weren't here. But if you remember, Jimmy Stewart in that character, he was suicidal at the time and wanted to throw himself off the bridge because of, you know, the shame of the family business and losing the money that his uncle had inadvertently misplaced. So we don't have Clarence the angel, but, you know, I do believe that we have, whether you want to call it your guardian angel, your higher self, pick a term that resonates with you, that when we do pass over, you know, I'll playfully say, they'll say, let's roll the videotape. And you look at your life. And one man said, who had a near-death experience, that he came back and he said, you know what? I just should have been kinder. That's what I realized. I should have been kinder throughout my life. You know, we look. It's our decisions. It's not, I don't think the gods care if we take path A or path B or path C. I think they care with the heart that we do it, the openness that we do it, the willingness, even if we're afraid and say, I'm going to stretch myself out of my comfort zone, and how we learn and how we treat ourselves and how we treat others. I think those are the ways. But I think you probably had a question that I moved away from. Sorry.
No, that's fine. No, we're going in the right direction here. One of the things that I find interesting when I'm talking with people who are dealing with some of these very difficult issues, whether it be suicide or otherwise, a lot of times I haven't been there. That's not a place that I've gone. That has not been a part of my path. Does not mean it won't be.
Right.
It could be. Doesn't have to be. But again, and I find that sometimes it's difficult to. It's one of those things where you hear this in movies and television all the time, where someone's explaining blah 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 blah. The person listening goes, "Yeah, I know exactly what you mean." And they'll say, "No, you don't. You have no clue." And I have no clue as to, sure, I've had my down times, as you elucidated earlier. You know, we all do. We all have those periods. I mean, I stand on the wharf down here, Stearns Wharf, at the end of State Street, overlooking the water, which we're probably about, I don't know, maybe 1,000 yards from shore.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes wonder what that would be like. Not like to just let myself fall over.
Right.
I don't know that I drown necessarily because I can swim. You know, but that's still, it's a pretty good height still to the water. We worked in a 25-story building back in Phoenix, and we were up on the roof one day, and I got close to the edge just looking down and wondering, I wonder what that would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the sudden stop is, you know, that's the one thing you don't want.
Yeah.
But, or even skydiving for that matter, which is the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my 49th birthday, the day before Michael Jackson was found dead. Mm-hmm. Well, when I hear about especially famous people who transition in whatever way they do it, my first thought goes to, I wonder what they're experiencing. What are they doing now? What's happened? I wish I could be there to see and experience that, but still want to come back. And it's like, and I have to say, and I'm not looking at going prematurely.
Yeah.
You know.
No. But you're fascinated about what that transition is and where that portal takes you, it sounds like.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, yeah. I've watched a couple of movies. Interstellar is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Where they went through a portal called a black hole. And it took them to a place that, I mean, my gosh, the imagination of the creators of the film, wow, that was pretty neat. But how do you know that maybe that's true? I mean, that was their vision. Or uh-huh. maybe each one of us has a different vision. And so we'll all have that different experience of returning to wherever it is that we came from.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going to bring it back down to earth here a little bit. We touched upon this before the break. I'm curious as to how you have gone about trying to undo the stigma surrounding both those who have attempted and survived, but also our society's attitudes towards it.
That is a fabulous question. I think it starts first with understanding. That's why I have a whole section of the book, just because when we understand context, right? Isn't it? Fiorella LaGuardia, I'm going to tell you a little story, was mayor of New York City. And every year he would take he would do night court for a while. And in comes a police officer who was having a problem with a woman, and she stole bread. And she stole bread from the local grocery because her kids were hungry. And so Fiorella, he puts down the gavel and he says, guilty, in the court, and all the press are there because he's there, and they go, ah, guilty. And then he gets his hat and he says, yep. and we're now all going to pass the hat. And he got everybody to, he passed the hat and everybody gave money to the woman, right? His feeling was, yes, you did wrong, and we're wrong that, you know, we all need to help one another. I think it's the context of understanding. There are places where one woman I talked to, her son, when he was in an Ivy League college during his senior year, had a breakdown, and he was diagnosed as schizophrenic. And they put him on meds. He was never the same. After graduation, he did some work on the West Coast. And then he comes back, and he traveled the world. He did a few other things. He was very, 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 very bright. And one day he walks in the door and says, "Hi, Mom," grabs a yogurt and leaves. Now, her son had been a champion diver, and he did dive off a bridge. And she said, "But you know, Adele, I look at it as a short but beautiful life." She said, because he was such a different person on the drugs. Now, he was an extreme situation in terms of mental illness that took him to a place. I recently hospitalized one of my clients who had moved through very bad depression, and I was brought in a number of months after the fact. And she had lots of, what's the word I want, delusions, right? She was psychotic, you know, she wasn't seeing things properly. And I said, this woman needs more help than I'm giving her. We need to put her in the hospital for a short period of time. And so we did. And now through the right hospital medication that works for her, not against her, she's becoming her old self again, and her family is thrilled and delighted. So we have places where, and she, by the way, in the middle of the night, the reason they brought me in is she was trolling on the internet on ways to take her life. You know, you have people whose circumstances just get them to a point where they're just so broken and there's nothing left. There's the story of the woman in Spain, and she is on the balcony of where she lives, and they had in the U.S. with all that crazy mortgage money and what have you, and they're going to repossess her place. And she is standing on a chair on her balcony, and she hears the bang, bang, bang at the door. Bang, bang, bang. She's refusing to answer it, and they bring a locksmith, and he opens the door. And when she sees them, she leaps. She survived for a little bit of time following that leap, but what happened in her death, it changed the rules in Spain around what you could do to moms or people with a certain income, people with children in the house, whatever their criteria were. Her death changed that. Circumstances sometimes lead people. If you have no money, on my way into work this morning, a woman I've worked with for years, and when she had money, she could pay me at a rate that she was doing, and she has no money right now, and I'll see her in a day or two. And she called and said, "Adele, I only have $116 to my name," because she works in the food service of a school, and the food service does not happen during the summer, and she's desperately doing anything else she could do. And she was a woman who said to me, "I think I'm going to drink Drano." I said, "That's really not a good idea. And let's, you know," and we put our heads together. So there are places where there is just circumstances, life, there's a lot of pain. And sometimes we're more resilient than others. Sometimes we can get through. But I do believe, and I guess I have to believe, Richard, you know, that we, you know, we try to help each other. We can't be all things to all people, but we do try to help each other and help people who fall through the cracks.
Where would you draw the line, though, when it comes to the first rule of survival? Take care of number one, because if you don't, you can't take care of anybody else.
You know, that's been a really hard lesson for me. And I, you know, remember years ago when they first came out, you know, you put your oxygen mask on first, and I was incensed. I thought, what? You know, and now I've learned that that is the right answer. That we have to hold our own, that we can't take on everybody's karma, because then we're not helping them, if you take it from a soul perspective, and we're not helping ourselves. We can offer what we can offer, and then I have an expression, kiss it to God. I had one gentleman who he's wildly successful, and through circumstances in life and a horrific childhood, when he goes through bouts of extreme abandonment, such as divorce or breakups or whatever, he gets on the edge and he has these thoughts. And so he said to me, "Okay, Adele, if things aren't better by May, I'm taking my life." But the wonderful thing is, I am, and there are plenty of fabulous therapists out there in the world, you can talk about this in the consultation room without somebody freaking out and saying, "All right, let's talk about it. What are we doing?" And I said, "Okay, I want you to write a letter to your kids." So the next time I saw him, I said, "So, how'd the letter go?" And he said, "I couldn't do it." I said, "What do you mean you couldn't do it?" He said, "Oh, Adele, you'll tell the kids." I said, No. Of course, I'll tell them whatever needs." I said, "But you need, they need to hear from you. It's not going to matter what they hear from me. They need to hear from you." Now, I was using a little psychology on him, admittedly, and inserting a pause. So if anyone that you love is in a bad spot and in that place, you want to insert a pause, expand their circle of support in whatever way, utilize resources. You know, there's a national suicide hotline number that, you know, they're there 24 hours, and I'm going to give the number, 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-8255. So if someone is in a bad place, what you want to do is you want to listen. You want to speak your truth. I'm not asking you to fix them. Just listen. Listen to the heart of their pain. Listen with compassion. Ask questions. But insert a pause. You know, possibility, hope, whether there are resources in your community, the 800 line or what have you. The gentleman I referred to who wanted to chop off his penis, his psychiatrist said to me, "How'd you get him in the hospital?" And I said, "Well, I told him the truth, which was, I know you don't want to go, but you have to go. And I'll be happy to talk to you while you're in the hospital, and I'll see you when you get out. But you have to go because I want you to be safe. I now want you to call your parents and make sure that they'll drive you tomorrow morning." And he did that. And in the morning he called me, goes, "I still don't want to go." I said, "I know you don't, but you have to go. Please go." And he did. Because he knew on some level that he wasn't safe. I'm not saying everybody who is mentally unbalanced is going to be agreeable. But, you know, with this particular gentleman, when you were talking about Steve Martin and Robin Williams, I have had a working theory for years that every thinking and sensitive person may get close to the idea of suicide, not to act on it, but to think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's thinking about what is life and what is death and what is my value and what is my purpose. But it does come up, and I just think let's take away the stigma, the judgment, and then the families are left reeling with just, "Oh my God, could I have done something differently?" It's brutal on the families. Brutal. Look at what they did with Robin Williams' family. I mean, terrible.
Just, it's horrendous. I have to say that when I'm watching, because you brought this up, when I'm watching the movie It's a Wonderful Life, I can dive deep into that space that he is in, it within
right.
myself.
Right.
When I'm not there watching that movie, I am aware of my value, my importance. And not in a narcissistic and egotistical way, but in a way that you've helped a lot of people. You've worked with a lot of people. You've had some incredible memories. You've made a lot of friends. A lot of people care about you and so on and so forth. And so you have absolutely no cause nor reason for, you know, going down that particular path. But when I'm watching that movie, the tears flow like probably everybody else. But I would venture that probably everybody goes through that, which, of course, really accentuates the power of theater and movies and television and so forth. And I'm wondering about that influence. I would think, too, radio as well, because it's still that kind of creative medium where they're trying to elicit a response, if you will. All you have to do is take a look at the presentation of War of the Worlds, and the world went nuts.
Right.
And I'd even heard that reenactments had been done years later. Same thing happened. People weren't really listening. they heard what they wanted to hear and still, you know, got freaked out. But what about that in terms of let's set aside our real world lives of our families and our friends and our work and play and all of those things. And we go into that realm of entertainment and we really get drawn in to the point where, and you've heard this before, I'm sure, there are actors who get called out by their character names, and that's how people relate to them because they don't disconnect from the program, from the story, from the drama.
That's right. Well, I think it speaks to being empathetic. When we're empathetic, we walk in someone else's shoes and we feel their stuff. Also, it's in terms of it's a wonderful life. We've all had experiences where we've gotten to a place, not necessarily to throw ourselves off a bridge, but there's something about seeing such a good man trying so hard and it not working. And we're with him and we're cheering for him and we understand, and good golly, it's not fair kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I also think the power of the media, especially radio, I think makes great communities, right? People listen. I know many people who go to bed with a radio, many widowed people in particular who go to bed with a radio because they feel less alone and they feel part of the world. I also think, look at Archie Bunker. You know, when Archie Bunker started on TV, what did Archie Bunker do? It expanded our consciousness. Mm-hmm. So the media can do that, expand consciousness, open us up to new thoughts and new ideas, look at things in a new light or a different slant, and reminding us that we're all one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This, to me, it's very important that we discuss this subject because it's something that's going on in our society, as you've stated, every 40 seconds globally.
Yeah.
And for whatever the reasons are, and there are as many reasons as there are people who are taking their own lives, but it is another form of transition. That's how I like to refer to it.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put.
Because that's what we're doing. We're transitioning. I use the example when I talk to people, I say, okay, Adele, how many cars have you had so far in your lifetime? And the whole point was to get from point A to point B, right?
Right.
Well, guess what? The body is just like the car.
Oh, that's great.
It's just a vehicle, and you're going to get another one. I don't know what it's going to look like,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, you know, you're going to be still going from point A to point B, but you're going to have a different mission maybe and, you know, whole different outlook on life and so on and so forth. So to me, it's, you know, this subject of transitioning or death and dying and curiosity, as I'm sure a lot of people have over what's on the other side, what's on the other side of that veil, as it were. And I find it interesting, too, when I get into conversations with people, especially those who have a faith-based awareness.
Right.
And they talk about it's appointed to man, it's appointed to man once to die, and then the judgment. And I go, but what about Lazarus? He died twice. Explain it to me, Lucy, because obviously, and then I've interviewed people over the years who have had both out-of-body experiences as well as near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just so much to experience in this world. And sometimes, you know, I don't know if this ever could work on someone who is despondent and just ready to check out. But it's like, it just seems like there's just so much here to do and to see and experience. Although I will tell you a brief little story before we wrap up of one of my guests was taking care of a 94-year-old woman who was sane. She was lucid. She was ambulatory. I mean, she was doing all the stuff that she loved to do.
Uh-huh.
And one day she came to this person and said, I'm done. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else I want to do in this world. She wasn't depressed.
Right.
She wasn't sad. She just, I'm done.
Right. Complete.
And she wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, why can't we do that?
We can.
You know? I know that here in California, there was a bill before the state legislature, but it was taken out of committee and, you know, removed from consideration. So Washington and Oregon, I guess, are the nearest states where people can go to seek that kind of assistance, if you will, facilitation. But I would hope that individuals who are considering it think long and hard beforehand.
Right. If, you know, Buckminster Fuller, the story goes that he was walking into, I believe, Lake Michigan. He was going to take his life, and the water gets higher and higher and higher, and he has some kind of epiphany, God moment, whatever you want to call it, and he knew then how he was going to change his diet, what he was going to do, what he was going to create, all of these things, and he walked out of the water. There is also an apocryphal story of Walt Disney being at a flop house. Again, Chicago seems to be the locale for all these stories, I'm told. I don't know why. And, you know, he's in the flop house and a mouse, you know, jumps over his feet, and the rest, as they say, is history. Mm. You know, sometimes, you know, we can all be like the Narcissus bulb, meaning that, you know, you're in the darkness for a while and then you bloom a lot when you get into the light. You know, that can happen, right? And yeah. and in terms of, I tell some stories in the book. One woman asked me, you know, is there a pill, you know, because she's lived her life in such a way. Another woman told me when her father was ill, she's an adult, and he said, please, she's in France, and he said, please go get my gun. And she thought, what do I do? All right, I'm going to respect him. I'll just get his gun. But he decided not to do it. And she felt because of the family. Mm. But it is such an individual choice, and people certainly have belief systems that, you know, and how other family members can, you know, I think as we baby boomers get, as we age more and more, I think this will become a bigger topic of conversation.
There was another organization or group of people that I was associated with. I'm not sure how much insight this gives you into me, but I was connected with or aware of an organization called the Hemlock Society.
I know what it is. I mean, okay, you're an interesting guy. You're worried about Robin Williams doing dark things on film? I don't know.
Well, it's, and I found it fascinating because the Hemlock Society was there for the express purpose of assisting people. And this was even before Kevorkian.
Yeah.
You know. And I know that through the study of herbs and this type of thing, my present wife has studied to be an herbologist. And I don't know that that was part of the curriculum per se, but I do know that there are certain herbs that are out there for the express purpose of bringing an end to the functioning of the human body and releasing the soul and blah, 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 blah. And that was part of what, and I love the terms myself. I don't know that most people do, but I do. That was the role of, let's say, the wizards or the medicine men or the old crones, if you will, with all due respect. That was their role, was to help, both to heal and to help.
Right. That would not surprise me.
Yeah.
You know, and that would people, because life and death and rebirth were a much more accepted phenomena. We're in a very youth-oriented society. You know, if you're older, you're invisible. Everything is about looking good and being young. And, you know, we kind of miss some of that substance, right, of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's very interesting. You know, what people will, I tell, there's a story in the book of a gentleman, of his brother, who attempted, I forgotten, it was 7 or 9 times, and he had the Hemlock Society book, and he tied himself to a tree in the middle of the winter. Nope, he was saved. He put himself in a pizza oven with a gas on. He was saved. He ended up, because he was a chemist, he ended up blowing himself up in a lab in the early morning hours, and he threw himself on the subway tracks in New York City, and he was pulled out. And his brother finally said, I don't know what to do. They had both gone through Vietnam, but the brother who lived was built a little differently than the brother who came home. And he finally said to him, come, we're just going to have some fun. So he would take him on weekends and they would go do something. And I don't know, remember what he told me they did at this point. And but they would have fun and they'd come home and his brother would say, gee, I had fun today. And he'd say, great, I'm glad you did. And he said, I couldn't stop him. I couldn't stop him. So I just wanted to give him as many good memories and that we would have fun together for as long as it lasted.
So let me ask you maybe one of the harder questions. When do you, as a doctor and a therapist and so forth, when do you say when?
When about what?
Well, if a person is bound and determined.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay. If they're bound and determined to take their lives, first of all, you have to assess if they are mentally sane, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if you are psychotic, no, of course not. If you are a young adult or a teenager, your brain isn't fully developed. You don't know that there are 27 more acts in life and that all these bad things will just become grist for the mill as you get older. Mm-hmm. You know, there are those things. But for somebody who has another story of a couple and they wrote to a family member and both of them had a terminal illness, but one got a second diagnosis of something that was going to be very, very painful. And they said when they could no longer care for each other, they were going to end their lives. You know, if I had been involved with them, I mean, I haven't been asked to do any of that. Mm-hmm. I did have one client who came in and her mother had attempted several times and her mother asked her and she goes, what should I do? I said, you have to live with this. You do what's right for you, right? Mm-hmm. And she said, I can't do anything. And I said, there's your answer. You're mm-hmm. fine.
Right.
And I think it's very hard for family members being involved. As a therapist, I'm going to spend my time working on you not to do anything. But there may be a moment where, like with the gentleman who was chronically suicidal, you know, where I said, all right, start writing some letters. Now, that he was surprised that I said that. It kind of snapped him back, which was my intent, let me be clear. But, you know, you try to explore things. In my work with people who are terminally ill, we want to make sure that no stone is unturned. So if that's what you're going to decide, then let's look at your life in every direction.
So in the process of working with counseling and providing therapy for folks, both the family members as well as the individual suffering with whatever conditions that are leading them in the direction of suicide, what do you see as your contribution, or how do you see your contribution to the betterment of society in this process?
Wow. Okay. Well, one of the younger clients I had would say to her mom, Mom, Dell is the feelings doctor. I like that. And I like that. I think I bring compassion. I think I bring unconditional acceptance and support. I am not afraid to shine light on taboo subjects. I love a good challenge. One psychiatrist called me and said, where do you get these clients, Adele? I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, boy, one is tougher than the next. I said, really? I had no idea. But I, you know, through my writing, through my talking or whatever, if I can touch a heart, shed a little light, offer some solace or comfort, then I'm doing my job.
I would like to thank you so much for sharing your time with us and sharing your story and the information about making peace with suicide. It's been an extraordinary conversation, and I hope that if you're ever in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue the conversation.
Oh, that would be swell. You're a great interviewer, and you're a lot of fun, too.
Well, thank you very much. I have three more questions, if I might.
Okay.
Who is Adele Ryan McDowell?
Well, these are not easy questions. Who am I? A human being trying to show the light, share the light. That's who I am.
And even though you've probably answered this question throughout the interview, I'll ask it directly. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Oh, that's great. I would love for suicide not to be shrouded in secrecy, shame, and taboo, and to be talked about. I would love to see some social changes so that people get the help that they need, like our vets, 22 suicides a day, our homeless, that kind of thing. I just want to open up the box, open up the conversation. But I also think for those who've lost a loved one, if they're open to the idea that, you know, there can be contact or communication through symbol or dreams or whatever with your loved one from the other side, you're not always as alone as you think you are.
Mm. And who inspires you?
Boy, most of the world, you know, whatever strikes me at the moment, right? When I see people doing outrageously and wonderfully good things that bring a tear to my eye, I go, oh my gosh, I'd like to be a little bit like them. I like being of service. I like being of service. Yeah.
I'm with you on that one. Yeah. And with that, again, I thank you so much for joining us on the program, and we look forward to talking with you again, whether it be here in Santa Barbara or there in Connecticut or parts in between.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.